I was very embarrassed that we know so little about strong gravity and things that we always talk about, gravitational waves, energy, momentum, and even things like black hole evaporation. We know very little about any of these things in the context of a positive cosmological constant. And it's basically out of this embarrassment, I've been sort of working extremely hard for the last couple of years. There are five parts to this talk. Unfortunately, I will only be able to cover basically the first two and give a hint about the last part. And the first one, the very detailed paper has appeared in CQG already. Can people in the back actually see this red thing? Okay. So otherwise, I have to go closer to the screen. So it appeared in the CQG already, and the two subsequent two parts are being written up here. Okay. So so let me start with the motivation. So first of all, in classical gravity, we got the notion of isolated systems. Roughly speaking, if we look at physical applications of general relativity, they fall in these two broad classes. One is cosmology, when one looks at the large-scale structure of the universe as a whole. And the second is isolated systems, where one ignores the universe as a whole and focuses on some stars or black holes and some processes that happen around them. And all the work about gravitational radiation and so on that is done in the relativity community, including a numerical relativity, refers to the isolated systems rather than cosmology. And then on the quantum part, it has to do with, as I mentioned, black hole evaporation and so on, and how we can describe it in the mathematical framework of general relativity. So let me begin with the gravitational waves, and let me just remind people, because not everybody knows, that there was a lot of confusion about whether gravitational waves are real in general relativity or they are just some coordinate effects. And this confusion actually is not some fringe things. Leading people who understood relativity at that time, like Eddington and Einstein himself, actually contributed to this confusion. Einstein, as you probably know, a year after he discovered general relativity, he published a paper giving the treatment of linearized gravitational waves. You know, this 1917 is all on, you know, well written quadruple formula he derived in that paper. But then in 1936, he somehow was working with Rosen and with full solutions to Einstein's equations and came to a strange conclusion that gravitational waves do not exist in general relativity. Wrote a letter to Born saying that, well, with my young colleague, Nathan Rosen, I discovered these new solutions. And it shows that although they exist in the linearized approximation, they don't exist in full theory. And this shows us how the full theory can limit us in unexpected ways. Well, there's a long, fascinating history about this particular paper. You can see it in the literature, on the web about Einstein's paper, how it was submitted to Physical Review, and then what happens to it, the referee process, and all that. But finally, basically, it was Einstein withdrew it from Physical Review because it was refereed, and Robertson actually wrote a 10-page report saying why it was wrong. And then Einstein sort of, you know, was upset that the paper was actually sent to a referee, because in Germany, when he was in the Prussian Academy, papers were just read by the academicians and they were not refereed. And so he sent it to this journal, Franklin Institute Proceedings in Philadelphia. And it was, of course, immediately accepted. But then, in between the submission and the proof, Einstein realized that there was a mistake. And so he changed everything in the proofs, and this is all available. So it's interesting to see all this history, and you can see it in the web. Okay. So there was all this confusion, and finally it was really resolved in the 60s through Hermann Bondi's work, and then, you know, more mathematically treatment of it due to Roger Penrose and others. And this was the notion of null infinity. I think most of you know that. Here is sort of a pictorial picture of an isolated system up here. And this system is sort of wiggling. The star is wiggling, sending out gravitational waves. And you always go in the null directions sufficiently far until we can read out the radiative content of the gravitational field. And this is done kind of most conveniently by bringing the null infinity. So this is called null infinity because you arrive it by going in the null directions. And this, you can carry out a conformal completion and attach this boundary. And that is what was done by Roger Penrose. And this is called Script I or Scry. And Scry plus is the future null infinity, and Scry minus is the past null infinity. For gravitational waves, you say that there is no, you have to impose a condition saying there is no incoming radiation up here. Radiation was actually produced by this gravity, by this object, isolated system, the star, and then there is outgoing radiation. And for example, if you have two, this is the RT plane, and therefore you have to cross it with two spheres. So if you take one cross section of Scry and calculate the energy there, the so-called the body charge or the body for momentum, and you look at another one, then this quantity is going to be less than this quantity, and the difference between them is a balanced law that actually the radiation went away. And so this was done, and then there is actually a certain universal group which we'll talk about, which is called the BMS group. And this BMS group, it turns out to be the structure similar to the Poincaré group in that it is a semi-direct product, but it is of semi-direct product of the Lorentz group with an infinite dimensional group of abelian group of supertranslations. And the as far as the gravitational radiation is concerned, there is a very nice gauge invariant way of looking at fields at Scry and singling out a certain tensor called the Neuse tensor at Scry plus, and if you say that or Scry minus, and to say that there is no incoming radiation means that Neuse tensor is equal to zero, so that is the boundary condition you put, and this Neuse, the so-called the Mondi Neuse, tells you about how much radiation there is in space-time as you go out to Scry. And as I just mentioned to you in a minute ago, if I evaluate the Mondi four momentum, which I think of as a two-sphere integral, so it's like a charge associated with a translation, one of these Mondi translations, say time translation for the energy, then evaluate at a cross-section here in the future one, minus and evaluate at the cross-section in the past up here, take the difference, and this balance law says that that is equal to the a function which comes from this time translation times the Mondi nu squared. And you can see that this is manifestly positive, so the energy actually that is carried by gravitational waves is manifestly positive, and this is kind of a fantastic way of gauge invariant way of closing the subject, and that is why Bondi famously said gravitational waves are real and you can even boil water with them. So this is all very nice, right? It's a very nice subject that we have got up here. Now what happens is that the BMS group is an infinite dimensional group, but it admits a unique four-dimensional abelian normal subgroup, which is called the group of translations, and that plays its role in defining energy and momentum. And if the Neuse is zero, then the BMS group reduces to the Poincaré group. So what happens is basically that if we have gravitational waves coming up here, then even at infinity, really, you cannot single out a unique Minkowski metric to which the physical metric approaches. There is an ambiguity. And that ambiguity is what enlarges the Poincaré group or the translation subgroup from four dimensions to infinite dimensions. But if there is no gravitational radiation and the Mondi Neuse is zero, then in fact, you can single out a Poincaré group at infinity. Or if you like, you can single out a unique Minkowski metric at infinity. And then its isometric group would be the Poincaré group. So this is all very well understood, it's very nice. And in quantum theory also, we use this Scry very often. For example, in the calculation of the Hawking effect, we've got a star which collapses, forms a black hole, you've got a horizon up here. And then the statement is that you give yourself a vacuum state here. You can construct the asymptotic Hilbert space of states, the asymptotic future Hilbert space of states, and you give yourself a vacuum state here, and then you want to know what you would get at Scry plus. And what you get is, of course, a mixed state, and that is the Hawking effect. So this framework is well understood. We all love it. We use it right and left, numerical relativity, geometric analysis, quantum gravity, and everywhere. Well, unfortunately, none of this rich structure goes over when you have got a positive cosmological constant. So with a positive cosmological constant, we do not have, even today, the basic notion. We do not know what the analog of the Mondi Neuse is. So we cannot tell in a gauge invariant manner if there was gravitational radiation in full nonlinear general relativity, not in the linearized approximation that is often used in cosmology. We do not have balanced laws. We do not have this law which says that, you know, that the Mondi, that the gravitational charge evaluated at one time minus another time is equal to the energy that is emitted. We do not have a positive energy flux. In fact, we'll see that there's a problem with this, as we'll see in a minute. And we do not have even the no incoming radiation condition that we would like to put at scrub. So we don't know what gravitational waves mean in the full nonlinear general relativity, the positive cosmological constant, however small. And because we do not have a nice translation group, we do not have a notion of positive and negative frequency decomposition that is needed for the asymptotic Hilbert spaces in quantum theory. And therefore, the thing that I told you about the last transparency about Hawking effect, we don't know what to do as of today. Okay, so I mean, this world in five parts is providing answers, but since four of those parts are not published, so when I say we don't know it, I mean it's not in the published literature. Okay.
So you know it.
I know most of it actually, most of these answers. In this part, what I would like to talk about is asymptotically De Sitter space-time and what the difficulties are. Then I'll tell you a little bit of a numerical about linearized theory, which provides some suggestions about what we should do. And then I'll tell you about the new strategy for gravitational wave physics with the positive lambda. And then I'll tell you about discussions. Okay, so let me start from scratch. And not everybody here sort of is familiar with things, so I just want to put everybody at ease. It's not that the details are important, but I think the level of discussion that qualitatively that you'll absorb would be important. So let's begin with asymptotically flat space-time, not De Sitter, but asymptotically Minkowskian space-time. So physical space-time is said to be asymptotically Minkowski if it admits a conformal completion, as I was just mentioning. So this is the physical space-time. This is a manifold to which we attach a boundary at infinity. And this metric G up here is conformally related to the old metric, the physical metric that we got on M. But the idea that the boundary is at infinity with respect to G tilde is captured by the fact that omega vanishes there and grad omega doesn't vanish there. That tells us how fast, if you like. It basically says that omega should go like 1 upon r and not like 1 upon r squared, if you like, here. So it tells you the rate of fall. Then the physical matrix, we assume, satisfies Einstein's equations, no cosmological constant, because we're talking about asymptotically Minkowski spacetimes. And the stationary tensor falling off sufficiently fast, typically one assumes omega to the minus 2 times this is a limit, but it doesn't matter. And scry, we assume to be topologically S2 cross R, and we assume that it is complete in an appropriate sense. So for example, you just don't stop up to here and say, this is my scry. We assume that in fact the generators and A of scry are actually their affine parameter runs from minus infinity to infinity. And this is important, for example, to define black holes. When you define black holes as, you know, you look at null infinity, you look at its past, and you look at if it is entire space-time or it's not entire space-time. Obviously, if you just did not have scry, which is complete, then you might get a strange result that Minkowski space is black hole. We don't want that. So we want to assume that scry is actually complete. Okay. Then the statement is that the field equations actually imply that scry is ruled by integral curves of its null normal. So it says that the scry is actually null surface that comes from the field equations, and the null normal is just, you know, omega is equal to 0 on scry, therefore if I take its normal, if I take its gradient, I get a normal, that is a null normal. And then because I got a cylinder, right? I mean, I have a cylinder which is, I got a cylinder up here, and it is actually ruled by null normals. Therefore, what is really matters, so it is really S2 cross R, that is a topology. So what matters is really this S2, and it is that is the reason why, this ruling is the reason why asymptotic symmetric group is reduced from diffeomorphism group of scry to the BMS group. Because what we, asymptotic symmetries have to, not only what, they have to, not only they have to be tangential to scry, because it is invariantly defined submanifold of the completed space-time, but it has to map these null generators into null generators. So it cannot sort of map this null generator to some other crooked null generator up here, and that is really the reason why the group is not the whole, all of diffeomorphism of scry, but the BMS group. And then there's a beautiful theorem by Ray Sachs, which showed that this group admits a unique abelian normal subgroup of BMS translations, and that, as I mentioned to you, is used to define both energy momentum in classical theory and to do positive and negative frequency decomposition in quantum theory. So now we want to repeat these ideas for asymptotically distributed spacetimes. So the definition is exactly as before, the same conditions that I wrote down before, except that you've got a physical spacetime now, and again you add a boundary to complete it. You've got a metric, which is omega squared times g tilde, the physical spacetime, exactly as before. The conditions, the conformal factor is exactly the same. The only difference up here is that instead of having zero cosmological constant, we put a positive cosmological constant up here. So usually this equation is written with the lambda on this side. And then the statement is that this physical stress unit tensor should fall off sufficiently as omega goes to zero. And then by examples, we want scribe to be either the topology of three sphere, that is what happens in De Sitter, or you might have some stars and so on, and therefore there may be punctures at scribe. And typically, there will be one puncture if you're an isolated system, or maybe more than one puncture. So the topology could be, for example, if there are two punctures, the topology could be S2 cross R. And it is again complete in an appropriate sense. So the definitions are exactly the same, except for this, and the fact that we can allow, for example, S3 topology. For physically interesting systems, it's going to be S2 cross R. So there again, the situation is the same as in zero cosmological constant case. Now, the important thing is that because you have got a cosmological constant, assuming it is positive, then the field equations now imply that scribe is space-like rather than null. Now, if I have a space-like surface, like, you know, a space-like surface like that, then the statement is that the normal to it is going to not to be tangential to it. So I got normal like that. And therefore, there is no ruling of this surface, right? So I just got three manifolds. It's not ruled. And therefore, I can just consider arbitrary diffeomorphisms of this manifold. And therefore, the symmetric group turns out to be just diff of scribe rather than something like a BMS group. Or I don't know what I mean by translations, for example. So I don't know what I mean by energy, momentum. I don't know what I mean by rotation. So I don't know what I mean by angular momentum, and so on. It's just a diffeomorphism group. You could try to work with the full group, but then it's difficult to do physics with that. And that is a problem, basically. So let me just contrast, before going on, Minkowski space with De Sitter. So here is a Minkowski space. These are typical time-like lines. So this is typically the trajectory of a time-like Killing vector field that would look like that. And these are T equal to constant Cauchy surfaces. The null cone would look like that. And then the statement is that if I'll go the Killing vector field, time translation, is time-like everywhere up here. And in the limit, then, it becomes tangential to scribe and becomes null. Whereas in this case, this is the De Sitter space-time, and we've got two cosmological horizons, and quote-unquote the time translation Killing vector fields in this case, which has a precise meaning, but let me just not get into that for a minute. So these time translation Killing fields are actually time-like in this quadrant, but near scribe plus and scribe minus, they become space-like, and they become path-directed up here. So therefore, near scribe, because scribe is space-like, and because it is attached invariantly to space-time, if you have got a Killing vector field in space-time, it must be tangential to scribe, and therefore it must be space-like. So every Killing vector field in De Sitter space-time becomes space-like at scribe plus or scribe minus. And because you got space-like Killing vector field, if I try to define a conserved quantity associated with a space-like Killing vector field, it would be more like a momentum or angular momentum. It does not have a definite sign. So energy of even Maxwell fields in De Sitter space-time is not positive, right? It can have any time, any sign at all. And again, this is irrespective of how small lambda is. It can be arbitrarily, the energy would be arbitrarily negative. So energy carried by electromagnetic waves across scribe can be arbitrarily negative. Again, asymptotically flat versus asymptotically De Sitter. Here is a picture of a black hole space-time. So this is a familiar classical picture. Everybody knows about it. This is a physical space-time, and this is a maximal extension, if you like. And I got a singularity, space-like singularity. with the positive cosmological constant, the Schwarzschild de Sitter solution has the black hole horizons, but it also has cosmological horizons. And therefore, I got a singularity up here, but heuristically, this sky, if you like, gets lifted, becomes space-like, and again, this sky becomes lifted, becomes space-like. So I got space-like sky plus, space-like sky minus. Now, if I look at the solution, and if I look at its maximal extension, it just keeps going on forever. And so typically, just as in this picture, you've got one black hole and one white hole, you'd like to have only one black hole and one white hole and not have another black hole here, another black hole here, etc. So typically what people do is to identify. And the beautiful thing is that this identification is possible in Schwarzschild de Sitter. I can actually identify a time-like surface here with a time-like surface here, and that's perfectly, allowed. The killing vector, the geometry remains smooth. The killing vector field up here, this d by dt killing vector field here is space-like like that, and it comes out like that. So when you identify, it's all smooth. Everything is smooth. But as a result, if I take a Cauchy surface here, then the topology is going to be S2 for each of these points represents a two sphere. Now here, the topology is also S2. Each of these points is two sphere. But for the Cauchy surface, the topology is S2 times R. R is a radial line. Whereas here, R is a circle, so the topology becomes S2 cross R. S2 cross S1 rather than S2 cross R, because you've got a circle in that direction. Now this seems like harmless. We did just this thing. But immediately there's a problem. So this is the same picture as before, the eternal black hole. Now, if I go back to this picture, and we know that this eternal black hole is idealization. If I have a collapsing star, as I had in the very first transparency early on, if I had a collapsing star up here, then the statement is that what is matters in the Kruskal picture is only this asymptotic region. This is all irrelevant. The R equal to 0 would be lined like that, the star would collapse, and I would actually get a singularity up here. Now, so that's what happens up here. Now, on the other hand, if I have a collapsing star in the De Sitter case, right? So this is the picture. I got a collapsing star in the De Sitter picture. Singularity is formed, and then I got this R up here. But now what do? In this picture, I identified this line or this time-like surface with this time-like surface. I can't do that anymore because if I have only one star, there's not going to be an isometry anymore. So either you put an artificially another star, and that's not the physical system you're looking at, or you just have to leave this alone. It's a funny thing that is left over here in space-time. And therefore, if you want to do a Hawking effect or something, where are you going to put your incoming states, right? In the case of, in the Schwarzschild case, you gave them on sky minus, that was a vacuum state. But here, that this sky minus is not good initial value surface, because information can flow in to sky plus from this surface up here. So I don't know how to do Hawking effect, right? I have to think about how to do Hawking effect. Where do I give the initial, the incoming state and outgoing states?
So I don't see the problem here. I can imagine the global foliation of the sitter, basically a closed cosmological space. Somehow I put a star in the middle of it, and then so it's basically less three, and then with a puncture, with a star inside of it, and then it collapses. So you don't.
This is a star that's collapsing. This
right.
Star
is
collapsing.
There doesn't have to be a boundary there.
Again, let's start from scratch. So the statement is that in this case, if you have a black hole which is formed, either I have a solution which keeps going forever,
yeah,
or I do this identification.
Yeah.
I don't have that in the asymptotic Minkowskian context. I'm claiming, so we can discuss this much more detail, but I'm claiming that there is no way to specify incoming boundary conditions. There's no good surface to specify incoming boundary condition unless you do something that I will show what when.
But you're assuming that there is a boundary. I'm saying there doesn't have to be a boundary. It's a closed universe, right? So then there's no boundary.
Let's talk about it later. I think that there's a problem. That this boundary is a time-like boundary. It's not a space-like boundary, right?
Why can you not choose it to be incoming null?
Incoming null?
Yes.
Like, yeah, this surface up here. Yeah.
No, so, the dash one.
This one up here.
Yeah.
So you want to choose it like that?
No, yes.
And then I'll stop.
Yeah, just stop there.
Yeah, so you could do that. You could just stop up here. And then the statement is that then in the Hawking effect, part of this information will go out.
Sure.
And so that has nothing to do with the black hole evaporation. So the H matrix that you obtain on Sky Plus has these two pieces of information. It's not the same. You run into problems one way or the other, but we can go into in detail as we go. I mean, there is a solution that I'll propose, so I mean, maybe that's what you have in mind. Okay. So there is thick asymmetries and body-like charges. Okay. So now, I told you a few transparencies ago that, in fact, we are going to diff scry. So I don't know what I mean by time translation. I don't know what I mean by energy. I don't know what I mean by momentum, etc. So what we could do is to maybe strengthen the asymptotic conditions, right? This is often done. If you strengthen the asymptotic conditions, then the asymptotic symmetric group decreases. And then maybe we can do this in such a way that we can talk about energy, momentum, etc. And there's a natural strategy which has been commonly used in the literature, which is the following. That we got this scry, which is scry plus or scry minus, and what we ask in addition to the definition is that the intrinsic metric on scry be is positive definite, but we ask in addition that this metric be conformally flat. So not it cannot be arbitrary, it should be conformally flat. And the motivation comes from looking at the sitter. In the sitter, at scry, the metric is conformally flat because the space-time is conformally flat completely. And so it looks like a natural additional boundary condition that you should impose on scry up here. And in fact, that is what is sometimes done. And now the beautiful thing that happens immediately is that now the group is immediately reduced because you're putting an additional boundary condition. And it turns out that the conformal group on space-like three surface is exactly isomorphic with the de Sitter group. So not only is the group reduced, but it's reduced to the de Sitter group, exactly what you would hope would happen, right? I mean, it looks very interesting. And therefore,
forbid all sorts of things. Are you going to say something?
Yes, that's the main part. Thank you. Okay. So now one can therefore define charges, right? Just like in the case of the bonding, in the following bonding. So what you can do is to look at the electric part of the Weyl tensor at scry, take a cross section of scry. So I got scry, which is a space-like surface. I take a cross section, and then I take this electric part of the Weyl tensor, plug it into, transfect it with a Killing vector field and integrate it on this cross section, and I'll get some quantity, and I can call it a nice concert quantity. And in fact, you do get expected answers in Schwarzschild, you just get mass. In the Kerr space-time, you get expected answer. For those of you who don't know, in the way that the metric is normally written, the parameter M in the case of Kerr, de Sitter space-time is not the mass. There is a combination of M and little a and little l. The little l is just the, maybe I should write it down once and for all. It's just the cosmological radius. So little l squared is just equal to 3 over lambda. So it is length that comes up. And one often writes also the h, the Hubble parameter, so say, which is just 1 upon l. That's the Hubble parameter in de Sitter, but sometimes one just uses this symbol. Okay. So we can define this object up here, and we get the Schwarzschild answer, and the Kerr, the answer is a little more complicated, and one has, like, people have shown that this more complicated answer is not just M, but it also depends on A and L, and this is essential if you wanted to get the consistency with the laws of black hole thermodynamics. But everything works out, and everything is very nice. So this is all fine, and now, so the statement is that everything looks fine. So the first two bullet points here are what I had before. We can strengthen the boundary condition. You can define conserved quantities. You have got de Sitter momentum. Everything seems beautiful. Everything is perfectly fine, except that there are problems. And these are two serious problems. The first problem is really, it turns out that if you can show quickly that conformal flatness of the three metric at scry is equivalent to asking that the magnetic part of the Weyl tensor on scry should be equal to zero. Now, if you have intuition from electromagnetism, and if you say that, well, I'm going to give myself initial data, such that the electric field is divergence free, but the magnetic part is zero. I mean, immediately you see that you have cut down half the degrees of freedom, right? Somehow something is wrong. The statement is that the same thing is true here. And secondly, these charges are well defined, but if they turn out to be absolutely conserved, if magnetic part is equal to zero, then they're absolutely conserved. We need magnetic part equal to zero to talk about reduction of the diffeomorphism of Scry group to the De Sitter group. But if you assume that, then these quantities are well defined but absolutely conserved. That means there is no radiation at all. There's no Bondi news. There's no flux of radiation through Scry. So that looks very bad, right? I mean, this is, as you said, it's extremely strong. It's not very good. Okay.
We don't live in a distributed space-time. We live in a supposedly in a flat that makes a freedom of rounds of open space-time. That's what we do in cosmology. So what happens with regards to the boundary conditions?
So with regard to the bound, so these are isolated systems. So as I said in the very beginning, there are 2 points. One is you're interested in large-scale structure of space-time, in which case you could do cosmology, in which case you've got homogeneity and isotropy. And that's what we use. Or we look at isolated system, such as, for example, the solar system or black holes or something like that. Then typically we don't worry about the rest of the matter. We just want to know the evolution up here. But what I'm trying to point out here is that, but there's also a cosmological constant in the field equations. This is not an issue of particular solution to field equations. Just like when Lewis does numerical relativity, he's not looking at, doing them in Friedman space-time. He's looking at an isolated system, he's looking at two black holes, and he has some boundary conditions. The idea is that these boundary conditions are perfectly fine to talk about gravitational radiation, far away from it, how much energy is lost by this isolated system. We are asking the same questions, but now in presence of a cosmological constant. And the question is conceptual question. Do we even know what we mean by gravitational waves? Do we even know how much energy they carry?
Black hole sits in FRW this time, yeah. Not in the sitter.
All right. So I'm not saying black hole sits in the sitter at all, right? I'm saying that the black hole is.
Let him try to walk before you ask him to run.
Okay. So basically, as we saw before, in the asymptotically flat space times, you've got some wiggling thing that is happening up here, it radiates energy. And you've got charge here, and the difference between them is the flux of the Bondi nus or Bondi nu squared integrated along this portion. Whereas here, if I had two such points, then the statement is that I will get exactly the same answer for the charges, for the energy here and energy here. And in fact, there is no Bondi nus which is coming out up here. And that does not seem to be physically right. It seems that one is actually overdoing something. And indeed, what one is overdoing is putting this condition. So the statement is, first of all, why do these fluxes vanish? For those of you who are familiar with asymptotic flat case, this is not really surprising, because in the asymptotically flat case, if we impose BAB equal to zero boundary condition at Scry, then in fact the BMS group does reduce to the Poincaré, just as diffeomorphism of Scry reduced to the De Sitter group here. And in this case, this condition implies that the Bondi nus vanishes. So we know this in the asymptotically flat case. And the same thing is happening here. So it says very strongly that this condition is very strong. So the idea up here is that the condition BAB equal to zero is too restrictive. But if we remove it, we lose the entire machinery we usually use to in asymptotically flat case. We don't have charges representing the set of energy, momentum, let alone the positive energy theorem. We don't have an analog of the gauge invariant Bondi nus. We don't have access to structure in simulations for black hole mergers to calculate, for example, kicks via emission of the three momentum through gravitational waves. And in quantum theory, we do not have obvious Hilbert spaces of asymptotic states in the full quantum theory. Okay. So this is the story, this is the problem, and this is the problem that we want to face. So what I'm going to do is to basically in the second part, tell you what the situation is for linearized waves. The situation in the full theory is always much more complicated. But the prerequisite, in some sense, to understand the full theory is to understand the linearized waves a little bit. And that provides us a lot of new intuition. And that's what we're going to do. So in the second part of the talk, I will just talk about these linearized waves, and then in the third part, briefly tell you the ideas for the full nonlinear case. So we can see some guidance up here. And in the lambda bigger than zero case, what we have been able to do is, first of all, make explicit the consequences of this BAV equal to zero condition. What is happening there, and it's not that we're adding new information, but we're understanding it better as to why these things are happening when BAV is equal to zero. Then we'll get expressions for energy, momentum, and angular momentum fluxes carried by gravitational waves, which are, of course, non-zero if BAV is not equal to zero. And they will tell you something. For example, even though it is true that for general solutions, the flux can be arbitrarily negative, as I've been telling you before, in fact, in the physical, under physical circumstances, which I will outline in great detail, this flux is actually positive. So it behooves on us and geometric analysis people to show that, in fact, these physically reasonable, in physically reasonable circumstances, in fact, similar things happen in the full nonlinear relativity. In the linearized case, we will show that this happens. And then there is a generalization of the quadruple formula. There are many subtleties to define quadruple moment of the object in presence of a cosmological constant. But this has been done. There are some, of course, there are corrections to the Einstein quadruple formula. These corrections, of course, all depend on the cosmological constant. Therefore, they are small, but they're qualitatively interesting. There is, for example, a tail effect. So it's not local, because in gravitational radiation in Minkowski space, linearized gravitational radiation due to linearized waves in Minkowski space propagates sharply along null cones. Here it does not in De Sitter. You'll actually propagate on the inside the light cone, and that has an interesting extra term in the quadruple formula. And these things are important, but again, that's a talk by itself, so I would not really go into that. But I will explain these three points here now. So let us consider the consequences of the BAB equal to zero condition, the linear theory. So again, this is mathematical subject. It's not that we're living in De Sitter, but it is more that just as we do gravitational waves in Minkowski space and learn something about it, linearized gravitational waves, we are doing linearized gravitational waves in De Sitter space and learning something about it. So here is De Sitter space-time. This is the cosmological horizon up here. The Poincaré patch is here, and we just, as in cosmology, we can just look at the Poincaré patch. Then I got this t equal to constant slices, which come like that. The De Sitter metric is, of course, is conformally flat, so you can take out a conformal factor, and you got just a flat metric up here in this coordinates eta rho. Rho is just the radial coordinate. I call it rho just because time is eta, and rho squared, yeah, etc. And then the statement up here is the following, that you see already here there's something funny happening. The conformal factor is 1 upon h eta. No matter how small the cosmological constant is, this is perfectly well defined. But if I take the limit, cosmological constant goes to 0, right? Then h also goes to 0. And therefore, in this form, the metric blows up. So the limit is discontinuous. I mean, what I'm trying to say is that so this is a bad way of taking the limit. You have to take the limit.
H goes to 0.
Yeah, h goes to 0. Sorry. Thanks. So there's a mistake. Right. I think I had L here first, and I changed to H, and then right. H goes to zero. Thank you. So the statement up here is that you have to be careful, and these limits are subtle. And now, why is this important? See, in some sense, what I'm trying to say here is that supposing that in the real world the cosmological constant is non-zero. So I do a calculation in the real world with the cosmological constant. But in numerical relativity, we're doing calculations using cosmological constant equal to zero. Now, cosmological constant is very small, so I expect the correction will be small. But I would like to find out how much they are. But as we saw, if lambda is equal to zero, null in the sky is null. If lambda is not equal to zero, however small, it is space-like. So the limit is discontinuous up here. So it shows that in order to really compare, if you like, the correct physical answer with lambda bigger than zero, small, and the calculations that numerical relativity does with lambda equal to zero, I have to be very careful, because this limit is discontinuous in some important ways, and this is not an important point, but this is sort of shows that if you are naive and say, well, if I just drop this factor, then I'm going to get flat metric, and that is a flat metric that I should work with. That is not right, because this actually blows up. So you have to be careful. Okay. So with this metric, then, I can solve the linearized equations. And as people here, cosmologists here, know very well, there are two kinds of solutions. There is a growing mode, and there is a decaying mode. So I'm all expressing it in terms of eta up here, the conformal time up here. So that the eta equal to 0 is chi plus. This is the future, space-like infinity. And the statement up here is that we have got two solutions, and their explicit form is written out up here, the two modes. These are multiplied by the polarization tensors. These are multiplied by the polarization tensor, and then I have to integrate, put a profile function up here, which depends on both k and h, and then I take d3k, and I will get a solution generic solution in space-time. So this is, so to say, a nice basis. So this mode up here, h2 up here, is actually the growing mode, because when eta is equal to 0, it actually is called growing mode just because it survives. Cos of k eta is equal to 1, and therefore it survives. Whereas this mode is a decaying mode, because when eta is equal to 0, this term is 0, and this term is 0. So if now it turns out that if you calculate the Weyl tensor is completely made out of H2. Sorry, the magnetic part of the Weyl tensor is made only out of H2, and the electric part of the Weyl tensor is made only out of H1, and that is why I call these coefficients E and B up here. So if I put BAB equal to 0, that requires that B is equal to 0, therefore this mode disappears, and in that case, the only mode I got is a decaying mode. Therefore, if I am at scry, I would see nothing. So that is what is happening. That already tells us that, in fact, by putting B equal to 0, we are throwing away half the degrees of freedom. That is what we thought intuitively was happening, but indeed it is true. We see it explicitly in the linearized theory. So it's a strong condition. What about the de Sitter momentum fluxes up here? So now the energy, let's begin with the electromagnetic waves to give you the setting properly. If it is electromagnetic wave, then the flux of the energy, or the total energy is sometimes called, the flux of energy across any Cauchy surface is given by just stress energy tensor times the Killing vector field corresponding. Yeah.
So usually, when in inflation, we calculate gravity some waves that are produced during inflation. You keep the growing model, right? So you kind of you do the other way around. Right? So there is So, but is that
but turns out that in fact you have to keep both those modes to really get the correct formula.
Usually the decaying mode decays fast, so the growing mode is the one that you keep at the end of the day. So somehow this is like very strong fine tuning at initial conditions that if you want to set the vehicle.
Yeah, it's very fine. You're throwing away half the degrees of freedom. That's what is happening.
But you want to stick with it, or you want to
Okay, so if I look at the electromagnetic waves, then C is a time translation, then the energy, the flux of energy is what I call. I mean, energy is just an integral on a Cauchy surface, but you can think of it as a flux of energy through that Cauchy surface. And I got a next surface, the flux of energy is conserved. Okay, so the flux of energy through that Cauchy surface, this is the current, if you like, and that we are integrating. This, of course, if in fact C is space, is tangential to this Cauchy surface, then this is just given by, as everybody knows, the pointing vector E cross B dot the Killing vector, C. This is the formula that you get if, in fact, the C is tangential to the surface. This is what I'm looking at, because at scry, all the vector fields C are tangential to the surface. So the formula you're going to get is always of this type. So the reason why you have to be careful about not throwing away this mode is because the volume element also blows up. And so you have to be careful to keep the two things together. Okay, now, what about, but now we want to go to gravitational field. But as you all know, for gravitational field, there is no stress energy tensor, which is defined in the invariant manner. So what do we do? How do we calculate the flux of energy in gravitational case, right? I mean, linearized fields. So what you can do is a Hamiltonian or a symplectic approach. So let me illustrate it in the Maxwell case, and then we'll apply it to the gravitational case. That's why I'm doing it here, that we already know what the answer is, but you can get that answer through symplectic or Hamiltonian methods. What we do is the following, that there is a covariant phase space you can construct. This covariant phase space is just a space of solutions to the field equations. And the Lagrangian, from the Lagrangian methods, there is a systematic procedure to endow the space of solutions with a symplectic structure. What is a symplectic structure? It's a two-form on the phase space. That's a symplectic structure. So if you give me two tangent vectors, A and A prime, A is a solution, A prime is a solution. This can be thought of as a tangent vector because the phase space is linear. So this is just a tensor, skew symmetric tensor, that if you plug in two tangent vectors, I get a number. And the number is just take A, take the field strength of F, of A prime, and then take A prime and take the field strength of A. And you carry out this integral up here. You can show that it is conserved, doesn't depend on M, on the choice of the Cauchy surface. And furthermore, it is gauge invariant. If I change this by gauge, the symplectic structure doesn't change. And now the important thing is the following, that the phase space here is a space of solutions. If you have got a Killing vector, then given a solution, I can make an infinitesimal transformation, which is really adding to it just lead derivative by this Killing vector of the solution. If this is a solution, since this is a Killing vector field, this is also a solution, and I'm adding two solutions, so I get a new solution. I mean, not surprisingly, you can check that this, in fact, is a canonical transformation on this phase space. The reason is because the phase space is constructed just using the space of solutions. And that is to say the metric and the wave operator. And here, a Killing vector gives me another solution. Therefore, I get a canonical transformation. And you can work out its Hamiltonian. And then the Hamiltonian turns out to be precisely what you calculate here. So you can get the fluxes, formulae for fluxes of energy, momentum, angular momentum. In a general curved space-time by just using the Hamiltonian methods. So let us apply this to now gravitational field, linearized gravitational waves. So we start with the covariant phase space of linear gravitational perturbations HAB. You can again use a Lagrangian. You can show that there is a symplectic structure which is nicely derived from the action, and the symplectic structure between two solutions looks like H times the electric part of the wild tensor of the prime solution minus the other way around. So this is something that we derive systematically. And then we can compute the Hamiltonians corresponding to De Sitter symmetries. So instead of this vector field C that we had before, would use any of the De Sitter symmetries. Let me just use the one of the time translations in De Sitter TA. And when you do that, you find that the Hamiltonian, first of all, again, as before, you've got a canonical transformation, so you calculate the Hamiltonian generating that canonical transformation. And you find that this Hamiltonian, completely generally, on the space of solutions of any field, linear field equation, is always given by symplectic structure, evaluated on the solution, and Li T of that solution. So this is the value of the Hamiltonian at that solution. So at that point in the phase space, the value of the Hamiltonian is just this. And you actually work it out, and you get explicit formula up here. There's the electric part of the wild tensor of this, and then you've got lead derivative of HAB up here. Now, as we just saw in just a while ago, if BAB is equal to 0, then in fact, at scry, HAB is also 0. If BAB is equal to 0 at scry, then HAB is equal to 0, and therefore, this is tangential to scry. Therefore, this term is 0, this term is 0, and the flux vanishes identically. So the same is true for the fluxes of linear and angular momentum. So this is not, so we see explicitly what is happening up here with BAB equal to 0. We're only looking at the decaying mode. And then the statement is that even though it is true that this quantity up here is blowing up, keep track of all the fall off behavior, and you find that this quantity is actually 0. And now, it is subtle. I told you that the limit lambda going to 0 is subtle, because if lambda goes to 0, then L goes to 0. And you just say that in this limit, therefore, this formula goes to 0, right? But of course, when you take a limit, you have to say, what are you keeping constant, right? There's always a subtlety. And here, it's subtle. I mean, it would be a nice 10-15 minute exposition about how you do this and what is kept constant. But when you do it right, you do get exactly the standard expressions of the Bondi flux. In the linearized case, the linearized version of Bondi flux, basically linearized Bondi nu squared, that's what you get, or sigma dot squared, if you like, in the linearized case. That's what you get across the sky. So you get completely the right answer in the lambda equal to 0 case. So we're good. But this exercise, at least for us, taught us how to take these limits properly. As you go from, do a calculation lambda not equal to 0, and go to lambda equal to 0. And that tells us what quote-unquote mistake one is making. If there was a tiny lambda, you know, I can calculate the exact answer, and I can calculate explicitly how much what I missed here if I just worked in a asymptotically flat context. So if BAB is equal to zero, not only we rule out by fiat half the degrees of freedom, as Naresh was saying, but in fact the remaining degrees of freedom do not carry any of the De Sitter energy, De Sitter momentum, and De Sitter angular momentum. Okay. Now this is an interesting part, which has to do with positivity of energy. Now, as I told you before, because the Killing vector field is space-like at scry in De Sitter, right? Killing vector field here is space-like at scry in De Sitter. Therefore, the total energy that I would get can have any sign. You know, in Maxwell's case, it is just E cross B dot the Killing vector that I got up here. And E cross B, that quantity can have any sign. It can be positive, it can be negative, there's no problem. So in general, of course, the flux carried by gravitational waves in De Sitter, linearized gravitational waves, can be both positive and negative. There's no problem with that. Okay? Now, I want to talk about the energy, which is to say the conserved quantity associated with the De Sitter Killing vector. I'm not talking about the conserved quantity associated with the conformal Killing vector or something else that you might be able to calculate separately. I'm talking about the Killing vector up here. It is both positive and negative. However, look at what is happening. Here, the Killing vector field is, in fact, time-like, and here it is space-like. I mean, I could give myself initial data here, or I could give myself initial data here, because this is a good initial value surface up here. And see what is happening. Here, the Killing vector field is all future-directed. Here, it is past-directed. Therefore, if I give me myself initial data everywhere here, basically what is happening is that this part will contribute positively to the energy. This part will contribute negatively to the energy. And therefore, by the time I arrive here, I can have both positive and negative signs. But in physical situation, we don't want, I mean, like this here, we don't want any incoming radiation here at all on sky minus or here incoming radiation. And therefore, the radiation that I have is all created just in this quadrant. And therefore, this radiation, because it's created in this quadrant where the Killing vector field is time-like, you expect it to be positive. And there's no problem with it. And we show in detail that it is indeed positive, even for gravitational field, which does not have stress energy tensor. So in this case, the energy will be positive. The energy registered at scry is conserved. You can calculate anywhere. It's positive here. Therefore, it's positive here. The energy coming here would have been negative. But of course, we are saying that that is not the physical energy. No incoming boundary condition will say that. So this is telling us that even though in De Sitter, or in asymptotically De Sitter space-time, the flux of energy can have any sign, in the physical processes, it will only have positive sign. So in this case, you can actually write down conditions on the initial data at Scry Plus, actually using some of the work that Yasha had done with Lucas. You can write down conditions on the initial data up here, at such that the energy is always positive. That to say, it captures correctly the idea that the radiation came only from this part and no radiation came from this part. So nice challenge for geometric analysis people is to sort of do this in the full theory, to say what conditions should the electric and magnetic fields appear, satisfy, to capture this idea that in fact there are no incoming radiation here and everything came just from here. So this is something I don't know how to do. This is something that requires very sophisticated analysis, but I think it's a very well posed problem, so they should be able to do it. Now, final thing is the following, that the expression that I wrote down on the last transparency up here, HT is equal to this. This is the flux of the energy. So I have a formula in the linearized theory for the flux of energy that is going out to sky up here. And this flux of energy is completely compatible with the answer that we have for the charges. So there's a candidate for the expression of charges in the full nonlinear theory. So in the full nonlinear theory, we got some answer. From this answer, without assuming BAB equal to zero condition, I can calculate what the flux is, okay, just from this answer. This has never heard of symplectic structure. I'll get some answer. That answer is exactly equal to the answer that I got using the symplectic structure. Therefore, this again, linearized gravity is telling me that what the formula should be at in full infinity, at full nonlinear theory for energy momentum, the analog of the Bondi two-sphere integrals, the Bondi charge, that one would have. Okay. So last part, and this is the full nonlinear theory, and I'll try to only sketch the main thing because it's rather late. So the strategy is the following, okay? There are two strategies, actually, and I'm just presenting one here. Yeah?
Just a question. Generically, if you have a positive cosmological constant and you have asymptotically descended to the future, wouldn't you have a singularity to the past rather than a prime minus?
No, because you could have a star.
You have a star in the city space, sure.
So
But there are also cases where there's a singularity.
There could be singularity, but just like, you know, in the asymptotically Minkowski case, right? We had an isolated system, we put it in the asymptotically Minkowski, consider the solution of Einstein's equation, which has a star which collapses to form a black hole. So we're doing the same thing, except that instead of using Einstein tensor equal to TAB, we're using Einstein tensor plus lambda GAB is equal to TAB.
So you're interested in that case because it's interesting.
I mean,
doesn't that open the possibility of the part of the diagram that contains its prime minus is physically relevant?
Yeah, so I think
that was yesterday.
Yeah. In a minute, we'll just let us come back to it. Okay. I'm happy to answer all the questions. Yeah. So this idea would be to, in both those strategies, prime minus is irrelevant. So in case you want to, so these two things. So, but in this strategy, what one says is the following. This is the process that I am interested in. Instead of looking at sky minus and sky plus, look at just this diamond up here. That is the idea. Now, the whole problem is how do you define this diamond in completely generic spaces, what structure it has, and so on. So I'll explain it heuristically in the next two transparencies. So the idea is that you can impose no incoming, idea would be to say that there's no incoming boundary radiation by somehow doing it here. It's not obvious how to do it. The reason is because this is right in the middle of space-time, not at infinity. So what do you mean by that? So we'll worry about that. And then the idea would be to try to also, how do you define symmetries here, to talk about energy momentum and angular momentum. Here I knew how to talk about symmetries. How do I talk about symmetries up here? And then how do I talk about symmetries and conjugate quantities up here? But the idea is that one idea is to focus on this. Since I don't have time to tell you about the other idea, they have complementary uses. The other idea is to look at all of this and sky plus, and not worry about this part up here. And for some purposes, some approximation methods, this is better. From some conceptual reasons, this is better. But let's not worry about it. But in both those ideas, we forget about sky minus, and you only look at this part of space-time, basically, which is like the Poincaré patch in the De Sitter case. But of course, it's not De Sitter. This is a general dynamical solution of Einstein's equation. So if we do this, then the statement would be that this was the, in this case, we are only looking at this patch. In this patch, this looks exactly like Minkowski space. I got killing vector fields, which are all type-like in this patch. Everything is good. About this point that we should discuss at the end, about this point up here, the statement is that now, if I just give myself just to worry about this part up here, then I don't have to worry about what was there at all. I just would like to know to specify the incoming vacuum state here, if I can, and then see what is outgoing vacuum state. Then for that, I would have to be able to do positive and negative frequency decomposition here, and positive and negative frequency decomposition here. Even the dynamical context, for example, when you want to take into account back reaction, there will be some dynamical fields which are going away from the black hole radiance, and one would like to do that. That's what one would like to do. And now the statement is basically the following, that in full nonlinear general relativity, the setup would be the following. We're going to focus on gravitating system for isolated systems, which remain really in a bounded region in physical space-time. So they're not infinitely far from each other at any time. At all times, the separation is actually in a bounded region, not only finite, but some bounded region. If that is the case, then the statement is that all these systems would define a point I minus on sky minus and I plus on sky plus. And now I look at the future event horizon of I minus. So I look at this power quantity up here. And I look at the future the past event horizon of I plus, this up here. And this is the region that we would like to be focusing on. Now I would like to impose this condition that there is no incoming radiation. This is the hard part. And there are very nice detailed papers by Bijak and collaborators which tell you how difficult it is to do this even in electromagnetic theory, no incoming radiation on sky minus. But here, we are lucky Because what you can assume is that this is actually, this was the event horizon, and we ought to impose a condition that there is no incoming radiation. But that's exactly what isolated horizons say, tell us for us, right? So the idea here is that we want to ask that this object up here, the future event horizon of I minus, be a weakly isolated horizon. Now, those of you who sort of know these things very well, this is really tricky because for a while, for almost a month, I thought, well, I'll just use strong isolated horizon. Why do I need weakly? But actually, you cannot. You lose something very important physical if you use just isolated horizon. You have to use weak isolated horizon rather than strong.
Does this mean that the which of the expansions is zero?
Yeah, so the area here is actually, so the expansion of the null normal tangential is zero. Sorry. So therefore, the area of this horizon is not changing in time. There is no flux of gravitational waves or any matter waves up here. So there is a very beautiful, you know, detailed work that was done out, worked out. Actually, there's one paper because there are some experts here, let me say that. There's one paper that was written with Chris Beetle and Jurek Lewandowski, in which Jurek went on in great detail about talking about the weakly isolated horizons. And at that time, I thought, why are we doing it? Why don't we just do isolated horizons? Because that's what will happen in the real world. But actually, all the equations that we have in this with this weakly isolated horizon is really important there. So Jurek's foresight was sort of a decade ahead. Yeah.
So, I mean, wouldn't we expect that if we're going to talk about radiation, so in general, if you're just going to consider some foveation with just two null surfaces and everything like this, then we'd say that the initial data that we impose on the surfaces, which are the graviton modes, are the shears. So why isn't it that the shears should...
That is implied by isolated horizon condition.
OK, right. So the shears also vanish.
Yeah, shears vanish. The shear of L vanishes.
Correct.
So this is a right way to capture the condition if you look at it in the detail. And now the important thing is that I really the transparencies removed some things. The important thing is that it turns out that because this isolated horizon, it has some symmetries. And you can get the time translation symmetry and three rotational symmetries without any problem on this horizon up here. So you do have these symmetries. In particular, you've got time translation symmetry, which gives you positive and negative frequency decomposition, and there is no problem. Now, what about this? Here, actually, the physical metric here is dynamical. Things are changing here. This is not an isolated horizon at all, this surface up here. But it turns out that you look at this whole mathematical structure in great detail, you're going to cross over two spheres up here. And then looking at the initial data, so to say, induced by the symmetries of the crossover surface, there's a way to drag these symmetries up here. These would be the exact symmetries had there been no radiation. So these are not the symmetries of the physical metric at all. But if you like, there's a kinematical metric, had there been no radiation, so to say. So you've got this symmetry, so you can use them, and then you can talk about positive and negative frequency decomposition, and you can define a vacuum state here, and then you'll get, you know, mixed state here, as in the Hawking radiation. The picture looks very similar to the Minkowski space picture. And then there are formulae that we have been written down for what the energy momentum, the flux of energy momentum up here should be. We have taken the limit. In the Minkowski space, we see that you get the correct answer in the Minkowski space limit when the lambda goes to zero. And so therefore, there's a good chance that all these things actually make sense. We don't have any proof of positive energy theorem. But under some conditions, the energy is positive. On the other hand, the question is whether those conditions are always satisfied, given the physics of the problem, or whether, you know, that they can be violated in physically reasonable situations. I do not know. So positive energy theorem is open. But other things are very, very much under control. OK, so let me summarize. For positive cosmological constant, literature has focused primarily on scry, assuming conformally invariant intrinsic geometry. And as was pointed out, this is, in fact, a too restrictive condition because it halves the number of degrees of freedom. And furthermore, it is ill-suited to study gravitational radiation in full GR and for quantum considerations. The inclusion of lambda, however small, introduces qualitatively new conceptual issues. For example, scry, and hence all symmetry vector fields, are space-like. So a priori, energy can be arbitrarily negative. And extra time-like you get an extra time like boundary in the collapsing situation, or at least sky minus is not a good initial value surface in the collapsing situation. And there is no peeling at sky, making it difficult to isolate the radiative modes there to put the no incoming boundary condition. The new framework is basically to focus on this, and then these conditions, these problems that I've told you about can actually be addressed head on. It's delicate, but it can be done. And one can find the required symmetries, both on the kind of these two horizons, or you can call them local scry if you like. This H minus and H plus, we can call them as local scry minus and local scry plus. You can find enough symmetries and fluxes associated with them. You can introduce positive and negative frequency decomposition and construct the Hilbert spaces necessary for the S-matrix theory and infrastructure for the Hawking radiation. I don't know why that got out. But several new elements from familiar asymptotically Minkowskian context, we have several new elements which differ from the familiar context. First, for example, the boundary conditions that we used in asymptotic matching, this sort of came up a little bit in, tangentially in Sarbach's talk earlier up here, if you have a cosmological constant. I mean, even in the isolated systems, we're not considering that, you're considering fluxes coming all the way. But even for isolated systems, when people use post-Newtonian methods, post-Minkowskian methods, they have to do some asymptotic matching. And that boundary condition is quite different here from what people do in asymptotically flat cases, so you have to rethink that. Then the frameworks for testing no-hair theorems that people have introduced, you have to rethink about it. But first of all, in fact, in the rotating case, the issue about black hole uniqueness is still open in the positive lambda case. Okay, so that's an interesting topic by itself. So we go and look for, is Kerr unique or not? Ever? I mean, it may not be unique at all, right? In the sense of, we don't know it is unique with a positive cosmological constant. So I know that. Again, I think in any real experimental observational case, you would have to put the numbers in and you have to actually calculate. And that is where this ability to estimate how much error we are making by ignoring the cosmological constant is important. And that is where, therefore, it's not enough just to say that, well, the cosmological constant is small, so I'll just do it flat space. We need to know how much, you know, what that error is. And that is what this framework is trying to do. So even in the transverse traceless linear approximation, in fact, the linearized field equation is not block of HAB equal to zero, but there is this extra term. It's like a mass term. It's a very tiny mass, right? But nonetheless, there is a mass term there. And that affects propagation. Why is this relevant? Well, it is relevant because LIGO is supposed to receive this, maybe relevant, because LIGO is supposed to receive signals from 1 gigaparsec. The cosmological radius L, where we're going to get corrections from, is about 5 gigaparsec. So it's 20% effect. It's not totally stupid or totally negligible or something like that. So it's not going to be important for example, the evolution of binary black holes, because the separation between them is completely negligible to 5 gigaparsec. Or even for the Hulse Taylor pulsar, as far as we are concerned, because the separation between them is extremely small. But even the separation between them and us is only a kiloparsec. And compared to 5 gigaparsec, we can forget about that. But it would be important to know, right? I mean, if I'm getting signals from cosmological times, from cosmological radiuses, right? One gigaparsec, then as they propagate, do these corrections accumulate? They don't. I mean, we hope they don't, but we as honest theorists, right, who should be able to say that they don't, and here is the reason why they don't. And finally, I think that there is going to be some interesting effects that will come up. I mean, like the Christodoulou nonlinear memory, which is something that was ignored for a long time, and suddenly people realize that there is a nonlinear effect, which is sort of interesting on the detector. So similarly, some qualitative things like that, I expect that they would actually appear. But let me just tell you finally that I'm not saying that work that is done in analytical and numerical relativity with asymptotic matching, with numerical simulations, beautiful, huge amount of work, the waveforms and so on, is all in danger or anything like that. I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying that there will be some small corrections, and we should know, we should be able to defend, and we should be able to say, these corrections are of this order. If you're not looking at this order, then don't worry about it, right? I mean, and precision of gravitational experiments, Hulse Taylor pulsar, for example, is very impressive. So we should know these answers. I am personally, as a theorist, embarrassed that I don't know these answers. That is why I spent the last couple of years doing this thing. Thank you.
about it because you're just a wedge. So what's the restriction of how big it could be?
Yeah, it shouldn't be a cosmological radius, right?
Okay.
So it's a 5 gigaparsec.
So you could also say that you could measure some quasi-local mass and quasi-local quantity within that radius.
So I think that, and the question is whether, that's the reason why there are two approaches, right? I think that this approach is going to be very good for approximation methods. We would be able to relate what happens in Minkowski, I mean, lambda equal to zero case and lambda not equal to zero case using this F scribe plus readily, because you can see that the two figures are approximately similar, right? I mean, but I think that for a fundamental reason, for fundamental considerations, like proving positive energy theorems and things like that, yeah. So basically, the statement would be that this looks, the proposal that I'm talking about, because of the similarity between this picture and this picture, I think that for making contact with how much error one, developing approximation methods, this is going to be useful. But for developing really positive energy theorems and really hard stuff like that, I think that what one would have to do, and there's a fifth of the papers that we're looking at, which is that what you have to do is to consider this wedge up here. And here, there is no quasi-local or anything. I mean, there's going to be really good quantities defined and so on. But quantities defined up here, it is not so easy to make contact with what happens in Minkowski space, in a full nonlinear context. In the linearized case, we have learned how to do it. So maybe we can, but I don't know. So that's why there are two approaches. Let's see.
Problematic. The city space-time issues affect the ADS-CFT projection.
Good. So no, they don't, because of the this is the sitter and not anti-de sitter. So in the anti-de sitter case, people routinely put, including me, so people routinely put condition BAB equal to zero on scribe, on scribe, right, exactly, in anti-de sitter case. This one does it very often. Okay, now why is it okay there? Well, it is okay because in this case, as all of you know, scry is time-like, right? Scry is like that, it's like this Campbell soup picture that you have seen very often in transparencies in ADF-CFT, and the physical space-time is inside up here. That's scry up here. Another point is because scry is time-like, in order to get a well-defined evolution, you need a boundary condition here, and this BAB equal to zero condition. One has argued that provides is a good boundary condition that will make the evolution nice in the future. People are interested in the mathematical parts of this. I'll discuss it a bit later because I think that there are some open issues there. But in linearized theory, in Maxwell theory, it's all okay. So I think people use this. This is called the reflective boundary condition. But in the de Sitter case, the scry space-like. I mean, there's no reason why the signal is going like that and should be reflected back, right? I mean, the evolution is completely well defined here. So and that is what is happening, that asking that it be reflective is really cutting half the degrees of freedom.
And so this H minus H plus region, is that the same as the causal diamond?
It's a causal diamond of two events, right?
Right. So this is, you know, the same thing that's been put forward as a preferred, by Busso as a preferred measure in eternal inflation. Are the reasons that push you to that being a preferred measure the same as the reasons that have pushed you here? You know, you need to be able to define things. Well, do you see a relationship between those?
I don't think that major problem is solved in that case, but we should talk about it in detail. Even if I restrict myself to this causal diamond, I don't think it can be solved. So I don't believe that. But you know, you can explain to me more. I looked at it some time ago. I came to some conclusion, and then I not forwarded up Busso's things. I think that there are issues with it, but we should discuss this. I don't have any.
Yes, at the intersection of H plus and H minus, is there still a two-sphere?
Yeah, it's a two-sphere.
Is there a role for a Hamiltonian, a quasi-local Hamiltonian?
Yeah. So I think that there is a Hamiltonian that will be defined here, and it could be that if in fact the energy conditions here are satisfied, then this Hamiltonian is positive definite. That's what we're trying to do exactly. Everything with all Gang and I have been looking at this using the Witten kind of proof. The difficulty is like to make sure that that the solution to the Whitney equation exists with the boundary conditions, which would give us a killing factor field here. This is the middle of space time. This is not, and that is the difficulty that we're
talking about. But apart from that, the formal machinations of the proof will
go. The formal part of the proof will go through, exactly. I mean, so lambda positive helps for that. It doesn't hurt. It helps for that. It doesn't create an obstacle. But you could also do an indirect thing, which is to do this bit up here, and then consider kind of a quotient surface like that, and do the positive energy here. That, I think, is going to be easy, because, or easier, because it is true that here, right, Hamilton leaving, which is really I zero for sky plus. This is really I zero, and this is really I plus. This I zero for sky plus, and this I. So I think that, and then if this is actually isolated horizon, then of course the Hamiltonian should be the same everywhere here. But these are all moral statements as opposed to functional analysis statement, right? I mean, because you have to worry about the corner conditions properly and so on. So.
Jan discussed the gravitational wave case. Did you also look into vector evaporation with expecting?
Yeah, I think that's several interesting things that are going to happen. This black hole evaporation, you know, there are several things interfere there. One is, there's also cosmological horizon. So there's a temperature associated with that. So we're sort of disentangling everything finally. So if you like, the basic equations are written down, but I don't have conceptual graphs that, you know, I look at the whole problem, I understand it. I'm not there yet. But because you've got time translation isometry here, you've got a time translation group up here or here, you can talk about the asymptotic states. That part is clear. Now, to really understand it from all angles is what I would like to do. That is quite open still.
I'm a little bit perplexed about whether I should think about the problem you're discussing as conceptual or operational and actually doing a calculation, right? Because you're assuming that there is a system in what I would call essentially an eternal decider sort of universe, right? So if the origins of the universe are different, then part of your space-time diagram will not be relevant anymore. We'll have to change in the same way that you cut off half of the sorting diagram if it formed from collapse. I could also say that depending on how my universe started and eventually evolved to some sort of decider universe where if that happens, this diagram would actually be modified in part of it. Is that wrong what I'm saying? Or?
It's not wrong, but it's not directly relevant for the following reason. So let me say a few things, and maybe I'll sharpen it as I say it.
Okay.
I mean, it's really like what, you know, Lewis or all the people here do when they say that, well, the real universe is Friedman, Roberts, and Walker with perturbations and so on. But I'm interested in these black holes and so on. So I just worry about Minkowski space. So that is the idealization one is making here, right? That is the same idealization, except that it's not, I mean, I would like to say that they are not putting it in Minkowski space-time. You can say that way, but I feel that the space-time is whatever it is, and the boundary conditions of relevance are the asymptotically Minkowski boundary condition because there's no because if you go far away, then the metric becomes Minkowski. So same thing is true here. This is an isolated system and so on. Now, if you're really coming to the operational question, right, then, of course, I don't really have to. I mean, the black hole wasn't there. The CMB surface, there was no black hole. So these all happen much later. So there's going to be an approximation anyway, right? So instead of this as being looking at I minus, you know, this is where the this I minus as I would describe. You can just think of it as if like this is the idealization of the epoch at which the black hole formed, right? I mean, basically, 1 billion years after the Big Bang, so where there is enough clumping in black holes form. So for this reason, I don't think that, you know, the singularity issue that was brought up is directly relevant for any of these things. If it were relevant, then it would be relevant also for their calculations, which would be much more dramatic. So the black hole that was formed, that we were supposed to be getting signals from, for LIGO and so on, it was formed, you know, 1 billion light years ago. 1 billion years ago. And a billion years away. That is what we're looking at. So that patch of space-time is being idealized like this. That's the statement.
Yeah, I guess my question is to which extent these problems are related to the idealization, which might be inevitable in order to do the calculation. So I'm not saying that the problems are not there when you actually try to calculate the effect, right? But it could be that the idealization essentially leads to this problem.
I don't think
and
so.
And then, of course, you have to find a way to treat it. Right.
I don't think so. I think that this is a, I mean, One can also ask the same question about scattering experiments I do in this room. You know, I think of the measuring apparatus being at infinity in quantum mechanics, right? I mean, and it's just a meter away, I mean, compared to, and one can say that, well, if there was, I mean, something blow up, I mean, I have to worry about, well, that was not really infinity. I have to say that there was actually a big bang there. That's somehow not relevant. So here's, I mean, intuition is playing a role here. And the statement is that these conceptual problems, you're right.
The difference is, I don't want to, you know, you see what I mean? The difference is that essentially you're talking about there's the issue of separation of scales, which I, of course, buy, and then the problems you're finding is sort of the fact that the global structure of space-time is affecting whatever local thing.
No, it's not local so much, but it is that I'm saying that some issues, such as gravitational waves, cannot be even defined. Electromagnetic waves, strictly speaking, cannot really be defined except you until you are in the radiation zone, right? I mean, because the statement is, this is a very interesting calculation that I realized only while teaching a course, I mean, and which is that you take Minkowski space, right? And in Minkowski space, you take a Coulomb charge and take a point on the vertex of this Coulomb charge, and then you look at how much, look at the past light cone up here, and you say how much flux of energy is there, right? I mean, how much flux of the E cross B dot, you know, the pointing flux is there. Of course, you'll get zero because there's no magnetic field. But now if you shift it, take some other point, not on the world line of the charge, and actually calculate it here, you'll find that there is non-zero flux of magnetic field. It's just that it goes like 1 upon R squared, not like 1 upon R. And therefore, when you integrate it out, right, sorry, it goes like 1 upon R cubed, the energy, the field goes like 1 upon R. Okay, so therefore, when you integrate, it falls off faster. Ordinarily, the field, radiation field falls like 1 upon R. This falls like 1 upon R squared. So the energy, which is square of the radiation field, will fall like 1 upon R to the 4th. I integrate on a 2 sphere. That gives me R squared factor. So still, I'm left with 1 upon R squared. If I have a finite R, there is a contribution. It has to be sufficiently far so that this 1 upon R squared is negligible compared to 1 upon R. So the statement is a notion of radiation, even electromagnetic radiation, not only gravitational, is not well defined until you are in the radiation zone. So it's not local physics. Normally, we really have to be in the radiation zone up here. And that is, and one is talking about, you know, this, yeah, so there is a.
Just to emphasize that, you can't solve the problem of whether a falling charge radiates unless you go to the radiation zone.
Yes, sir. For the same reason, because here I got a Coulomb field, and I look at E cross B. Actually, somebody asked me, it was not. So some student asked me that question, right? Well, I know what radiation means. I just calculate. Good experimental students, so you know, he asked me these hard questions. E cross B, you know, that this is, I just calculated this and that is zero. And then I have to do in the class and show that, in fact, no, it's not zero. it goes like 1 upon R to the 4th. And therefore, when you integrate out, I still get 1 upon R squared contribution, which is not zero.
So there are a number of So there are candidates for quasi-local energies and masses. So there's like the Hawking energy, the surface energy, the Hayward energy. So is the charge formula that you found that the experiment is the one that you defined in one of the previous slides? Does it? I mean, have you checked if it coincides with any of these formulas?
No, because in the, I mean, it's really the isolated horizon charge, if you like, which is not. It doesn't agree with, I mean, in the non-rotating case, of course, it does agree with Hawking, you know, definition. But in the rotating case, it doesn't agree with the Hawking definition.
Right, but then there usually is also a generalization of even the Hawking energy, right? It's like the, I think it's called a Hayward energy.
What is it called?
Hayward energy.
No, so this is different from Hayward energy. Okay. Yeah, this is different. Okay, so...